I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
And John, we're back. It's the Functional Nerds. It's a podcast. We have a guest.
Yes. It's been kind of a while since we've had a guest, but today we're joined by Anna Smith Spark. Ooh, Smith Spark. Say that 10 times fast. She is the author of the grimdark fantasy series Empires of Dust. It's published by Harper Voyager in the UK, and it's published by Orbit here in the US. And she was Gemmel and BFS shortlisted. Anna, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You have perhaps the one of the better Twitter names, at Queen of Grimdark.
Yes.
that's a good one. What inspired you to pick that Twitter name?
The short answer, it was a joke. The lovely Michael R. Fletcher, author of Beyond Redemption, who is a very good mate of mine. We troll each other, being how grimdark are you to each other. Suggested I should become the Queen of Grimdark, and I'm now stuck as the Queen of Grimdark, and I have personally apologised to Joe Abercrombie, who tweets as Lord Grimdark, for the number of tweets you must get after making jokes about the fact I must be married to him. So yet again, apologies, Joe. I know people never stop thinking it's funny trying to work out whether I'm his sister or his wife. Actually, I have this slightly bizarre thing where let's get into the politics already. Because I'm a female author, right? People seem to think I write YA. So the Queen of Grimdark thing is a bit kind of... And this, people have seen my book in the YA section of Children of Bookshops, which... any parents out there who someone bought your 10-year-old my book? I'm really sorry. It wasn't me. It was the bookseller. But Queen of Grimdark is kind of... It's kind of a way of pointing to people that this book is, it ain't YA, it ain't urban romance,
it's grimdark fantasy.
Yeah, it's it's grimdark fantasy.
Now, for many of our listeners are very involved in the science fiction and fantasy community, and they are well aware of what grimdark is, but perhaps for some of our listeners who aren't as entrenched in the community, and grimdark is clearly we can call it a subgenre. How would you, if for someone who's read some fantasy, but maybe hasn't read what would be considered grimdark, how would you describe it to them?
I take it as a kind of cynicism, as a kind of, Game of Thrones is very grimdark. It's that kind of, you're taking those kind of that, the heroism, and you're kind of pointing to the cynical reality behind it. There's a lot of people say, it's really violent. And a lot of grimdark novel has got violence in it, but it's not about the violence. What it's about is that kind of moral complexity of going beyond just the idea of, you know, there's a hero, and what that hero is doing is good. It's interrogating the whole notion that, you know, there's the goodies and the baddies. That kind of, I mean, in sort of high fantasy from Tolkien onwards, you get that real sense of kind of there is evil, and the people confronting evil are good, and their actions are fundamentally good and noble. And grimdark is kind of interrogating that and asking questions about what morality is and what people's motivations really are. So the kind of classic, I guess, is the kind of some of what happens in the first, particularly the first couple of books in Game of Thrones, the kind of classic Ned Stark. He talks very much about what's right. He talks about morality. He talks about doing what's right, not what's easy or what's kind of comfortable. He's sort of presented in the first couple of chapters, the beginning of the first book and the first couple of episodes of the first series of Game of Thrones as, you know, this kind of very upright, virtuous, good man. And then it all comes crashing down because the reality of what he's doing, of course, is actually just completely destabilizing the country, destabilizing his own family, and spoiler alert for the two people out there somewhere in the world who've been living in Antarctica for the last 10 years and haven't watched Game of Thrones, he gets his head chopped off. And it's that kind of interrogation of kind of what the drivers behind people's behaviour and the consequences of their behaviour. And the fact that actually kind of even if most of us aren't good people, and even if we are good people, in inverted commas, there are horrible consequences for others of our own actions. And that for me is grimdark. It's that kind of cynicism about human motivations and human actions and the reality of kind of how crap life is, basically. Also with that, but with at the same time that kind of sense of striving in there still. It's not just that kind of, it's not just absolutely just kind of, hey, everyone's just evil and everything's just vile and life is just hell and why don't we just spend such a risk and now it would be better, the world would be such a better place without human beings. Grimdark's always described being very visceral. There's a lot of stuff about the body, there's a lot of stuff about, it's about that kind of mucky reality that actually life is messy and horrible and unpleasant, and most of us are pretty selfish, unpleasant people. At the same time, life is really worth clinging on to. You know, life is just so precious and so fragile and so worth clinging on to. And that for me is grimdark.
Yeah, I think that's a really accurate way, or I think it's in line with the way that I think about it, at least too. And I think the Game of Thrones example is quite a good one, because for people who have read the books, in addition to watching the series, you are led to believe like, oh, the Starks are the good guys and the Lannisters are the bad guys. Yet, as you read, even just within the first book, you know, and as you move on, the Starks make some questionable decisions at points that aren't always noble and good. And the Lannisters surprise you. You find yourself rooting for Jaime, who is, you know, at one point presented as such a horrible person. You find yourself rooting for him and Tyrion. So it is that, yes, it's not always all good, all bad. There are, you know, everybody makes decisions based on their circumstances, and sometimes those decisions can be looked at as being good and noble and sometimes not.
Yeah. So
I think that's a really good way of putting it.
I mean, I got some stick for doing a blog post where I was kind of saying that I see the Starks as kind of the villains of Game of Thrones. And lots of people coming in saying that, again, people having this very kind of had a very kind of binary, well, if I thought the Starks were the villains, that must mean I thought Joffrey was the hero, because the idea that they had this sense you had to have a good and a baddie, and if I was saying the Starks were fundamentally villains, then that presumably meant Joffrey must be the hero, which is not what I meant at all. But that, you know, Ned Stark is essentially presented as a fascist. There's that horrifying line where he talks about, he takes his sons out at the very beginning of the book. He takes his sons out. He gives them this big speech about he is chopping this man's head. He's chopping this criminal's head off himself, because he must look someone in the eyes as he kills them. And it is, you know, it is right and noble that he does it himself. And actually, it's the speech of a fascist. But we're presented with this image of this kind of heroic, this sort of noble, you know, he's noble, he's upright, standing, he's... And if you look at some of this language in that book, to get incredibly political, I guess some of you guys in America are probably possibly more familiar with some of the way some of that language is being used recently than even I am over here. I mean, you can interrogate it in all kinds of interesting ways, that kind of what's going on in that kind of hero trope and what Martin seems to be saying about that sort of hero figure. And I find it absolutely chilling. I find the Starks absolutely chilling as these kind of, as figures and as what it is they're actually projecting.
Yeah, well, obviously it struck a chord with a lot of people, and so great. All right, so now as we move on into our next segment, before we do that, I want to thank all the people who are supporting this podcast. And if you would like to support the podcast, you can do that over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. You can donate $1 a month or any amount that you would like. It really helps us out. And again, to the people who are already backing us, thank you so much. It really means the world to us, and we're very appreciative of it. And for people who are listening who aren't backing us, consider becoming one of our backers. It helps out a lot. If you get value from the show, if you enjoy interviews with folks like Anna, if you enjoy our recommendations and anything else about the community, it really helps a lot. And we're greatly appreciative of it. So once again, patreon.com/functionalnerds. Now let's get on to our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
And Anna, why don't you go first and let us know what your pick of the week is?
Ooh, my pick of the week. Can I go for two picks of the week? Because one of them's completely bizarre and completely random. So I'm completely obsessed with the Volta España cycle race at the moment. I'm completely bloody obsessed with it. It finishes tomorrow. So if by the time this podcast is broadcast, sadly, it will be no more. But it's 3 weeks of blokes in skin-tight lycra cycling up and down incredibly high mountains, like literally racing each other up mountains on bicycles in skin-tight lycra. And they all claim to not be on drugs anymore, but up until very recently, they were on huge amounts of drugs, and occasionally they do fall off the mountain. They do crash and fall over the side of mountains and literally die. And it's just awesome. It's like people racing each other up mountains with 20 degree gradients in the baking Spanish heat. It's absolutely fantastic, but it is not particularly in science fiction genre.
Is this it's okay. Is that an international competition?
It's a grand tour cycling it's going around. It's teams from all over the world. There's a British guy winning at the moment actually, but I don't want him to win even though he is from my home country. But it's teams from all over the world, riders from all over the world, racing. They're doing a kind of tour. They do about 100 to 200 kilometers racing every day in a different bit of Spain, and they kind of do a tour around the whole of Spain, racing up and down mountains. And it's ace. I love grand tour cycling. It's just bonkers. It is the most insane sport. It's just, people who do it are complete masochistic lunatics. It's just bonkers. I love it.
Before you do your next pick, about 15 years ago, my wife and I, when we got married, we went on our honeymoon to Hawaii, and we spent some time on Maui. And on Maui, there is a mountain called Haleakala. And what you can do is you can take a van or a bus up the mountain at about 4 o'clock in the morning, and it's 10,000 feet above sea level. And when you're up there, it's freezing, even though you're in Hawaii.
Yeah.
And you watch the stars and it's beautiful. And then when the sun rises, you're actually above cloud level when you're that high up.
Yeah.
So you see the sun coming up through the clouds. It's an amazing sight. Probably only a few places on Earth where you can do that. But why I bring that up is because we just took a bus up and then took a bus back down. We saw people riding bikes on the way down. And our bus driver was telling us, oh yeah, you could take the tour, whereas you take the bus ride up, and then instead of taking the bus ride down, you can ride a bike going down. And I was looking, I'm like, there are sections of this road that don't have guardrails. I'm like, that must be dangerous. And he's like, yeah, like 2 or 3 people die every year doing it. I'm like, why would you do that? But that's maybe, yeah, I don't know why one would do that.
Yeah, when they race up, and they do actually. I mean, they do race each other up. They're racing up several kilometers at 10%, 20% gradient, racing each other up. And when they're going down, they're going 70, 80 k an hour downhill, round hairpin bends, down mountains. Yeah, grinning away like maniacs. And yeah, they do occasionally. Yeah, go off the side.
Yeah. there's a similar race here. I don't know the name of it, but it's on Mount Evans. And it's very similar to what you're describing, John, in that when you're up there, you're above the clouds. Mm. And there's also a NASA observatory up there.
Nice.
But there's some sort of bike race that happens, and there's also a lot of training throughout the summer. If you go up there, you'll see people on bikes training for races.
They're improving their stamina. I love grand tour. I love grand tour cycle racing. It's the only sport I have any interest in, and it's. I mean, I never do it myself. I could never go on a bike myself, but I absolutely love watching it. It's just insane. The people who do it are just absolutely insane. It's a sport Lance Armstrong used to do, and he'd be like, the great disgraced American cyclist.
Yes.
And he'd be like, he'd be like coming off his bike to have. Be injected with his own blood and then get back on his bike and carry on racing up the mountain and stuff. It's just, they are just all in absolutely skin tight lycra. They are just They are absolutely. It's the only one of the only sports where the participants actually have shorter life expectancies than those of us who lies around on the sofa watching TV and eating donuts.
Yes.
They're putting their bodies under so much stress.
The craziest thing I ever saw was I was up in Estes, and I went up into Rocky Mountain National Park. And as I'm coming back down, the storm hit, and it was raining like crazy. And there was this random guy. He was not wearing the bike stuff. He was just wearing like blue jeans and a shirt, riding a bike back down from Rocky Mountain National Park in the rain.
Mm.
Probably doing, you know, 70, 80 mile an hour, which I don't know how that translates to kilometers, but just going super fast, crazy on this bike, probably not able to stop himself because of the rain.
Yep.
Crazy. What was your other pick, Anna? You said
my other pick was actually to talk about something slightly more genre. I've finally been watching The Last Kingdom, which is I don't know if it's Ooh. I think you guys have had it over in America. I mean, it's about
it's on Netflix.
Yeah, it's about Saxons and Vikings, and it's just really cool. I mean, it's it's hilarious because you're kind of watching it and you are sort of thinking like, God, this is so much like Game of Thrones. They're just every character, you're kind of like, okay, I can work out which character of Game of Thrones that character is kind of meant to be. the hero is basically obviously just kind of meant to be Jon Snow, but he's even more dumb than Jon Snow is, which is impressive. But finally this kind of woman walked on, and I was sort of like, after something like six episodes, they finally decided they needed Melisandre, so they've got Melisandre on finally. It is kind of so obvious, but it's just fantastic. It's got this mad kind of music, which is not in the slightest bit Saxon. It's this kind of weird sort of ethnic inverted commas music, which doesn't suit it at all, but really it doesn't suit the period at all, but it really gives you some, it's a great soundtrack. It's totally inappropriate, but it's great. And it just gives you, it's really, I like the sense it's giving you of the world. Again, Britain does not look anything like that. It's not filmed in Britain.
You're saying Britain doesn't look anything like Toronto?
It's really bizarre watching it, like, oh yes, the mountains of the South Downs, know them well. There's vast expanses of conifer forest that, yes, kind of.
That show's one of the ones where every time the main character he'd do something very, very pagan and Viking-esque, and the king would suddenly no longer trust him, you know, because he's not being a good Christian. I wanted to smack everybody. Because it's almost like a trope within that show. It's like, oh, I've earned the king's trust. Now I must do something very Viking. And then the king's like, I no longer trust you because you're not being a Christian.
Yeah, I mean, what I find interesting about it is the way it shows Anglo-Saxon England as essentially a kind of fundamentalist Christian state, which you kind of get the feeling it was. They are so obsessed with their religion. I think it is really interesting the way it really does show this kind of state, and the way it contrasts, the Vikings do kind of clearly have a certain joie de vivre, which the Anglo-Saxons just don't. It kind of can't help but be on the side of the Vikings, even though it kind of really feels it shouldn't be. And it is interesting the way it shows Saxon Britain and kind of the way it shows these cultures that are the same but very different, and they both feel very kind of alien. It's not got that these people are just like us, and they're just like us but wearing funny clothes, and for some reason they have idiot ideas. You do have a sense of it being an alien world and it being an alien way of thinking. Both kind of their cultures, the Roman, the Viking and the Saxon, being quite different to the way, and they are kind of alien and different, and yet you can recognise elements of kind of British culture in both of them. It's really, I think it is actually quite well done, although kind of the complexity of the world is really well done, even though you are just every week, you're just, oh, they're going to make another dumb decision. Oh, they've made another dumb decision. Oh, they're going to make another dumb decision. And now they're going to get really upset.
There's one that's on Prime here. It's called Britannia.
Oh, I haven't watched that. That just looks, I mean, that looks so, so bonkers. And as a as a classical historian, I don't think I could face the thought of watching it. I think I'd just be screaming at the TV.
Okay.
It just looks so insane. It kind of.
So, Patrick, what's your pick? Is it Britannia or is
it... No. I actually changed my pick 3 times since we started the podcast.
I did that.
And the third change was due to something that Anna said. So I've mentioned her a few times before. Do you know the author Carrie Vaughn?
No.
Anybody? Okay, so she writes urban fantasy, but she also writes some other stuff. She's part of George R. R. Martin's Wild Cards universe. She writes in that. And she's got a couple of everything. What she kind of became famous for was the Kitty Norville series. And Kitty is she's a werewolf who hosts a late night radio talk show. And it's all set in Denver. And people would call in to Kitty in the midnight hour with their supernatural problems. And that's kind of that series. But she started doing something, and she started it on Facebook, and now she actually has a blog where she's posting it, and it's called It's Tough Being Cobra These Days. And it's all about how recently Cobra Commander was sitting in the lair of Cobra watching late night television, and he gets really upset because he's supposed to be the cartoon fascist.
Yeah.
And it just goes on from there. And you kind of have Cobra Commander and Destro and the Baroness realizing there's not really anything for them to do anymore. And they're trying to find their way and kind of figure out what they're supposed to be doing. And they're kind of also like going out and finding the various Joes. And like there's one where Destro finds, I believe it's either Duke or Hawk, sitting in a bar getting drunk because Hawk kind of feels like he lost the war, but he doesn't realize how or when. So it's a hilarious series that she's just started writing. And you can actually find it if you search It's Tough Being Cobra Today, or it's Tough Being Cobra These Days. You'll find it. She moved it from Facebook to a WordPress .com blog, and it is just absolutely hilarious. You have all the characters from Cobra and G.I. Joe, you know, kind of having these conversations about how their world has been flipped upside down, and Cobra just doesn't know what to do with themselves, and the Joes don't know what to do with themselves. It is hilarious.
I just clicked on it. I was like, God, that sounds like something I would enjoy.
The first couple of times I saw it on Facebook, I just busted up, and I'm so happy that she's put it out on a WordPress blog.
Yeah, so.
That sounds really that really sounds like something to look. Yeah, that sounds good.
It's worth it. Yes.
Cool. My pick this week is a book. It's the author's name is K-A-Y Larson. And it's a nonfiction book, and it's titled Where the Heart Beats, John Cage, Zen Buddhism, and the Inner Life of Artists. And I think this is a wonderful book for really just about any creative person or anybody that's interested in creativity. John Cage, if you may or may not know, is was a classical composer, most well known for his piece 4 minutes and 33 seconds of silence. Which that's what it is. There's music written, and I know it always sounds very gimmicky, and I always perceived it that way as well. But when you read this book, you learn so much more about his journey as an artist and as a human being, and how artistically that piece actually is very meaningful. And I just really loved this book because it goes through his whole life, and it goes through how he discovered Zen Buddhism, because that was a new thing in the United States at the time. And it's kind of an interesting thing because coming from Japan, it sort of makes its way over here not long after World War II. So Japan was the enemy at that time. So to suddenly have this philosophy that many Americans were starting to get interested in, it's an interesting time period. But it gets into mostly of as an artist and how your ego can be so damaging to your art, but also to just being a human being, and how John Cage and all of the artists that were around him. He was a kind of the linchpin of a whole artistic community of not only composers, but visual artists and poets and dancers and everything. So it's, if you're interested in this kind of thing, I think it's a really excellent book. It's a deep book, and I found it quite a challenging book to read as well. It's very well written, but there are just some very deep, meaty topics in it. So if you're in the mood for something like this, I really highly recommend it. It's Kay Larson is the author, Where the Heart Beats, John Cage, Zen Buddhism, and the Inner Life of Artists.
Oh, that sounds really interesting. That sounds, I love modernist music. I've brought up with high modernist poetry, and I love modernist poetry, modern American abstract art, and that sounds, and the neat music. So, yeah, no, it sounds really interesting.
You'll love this then, because they spend a lot of time, because it's not really just about him. They spend a lot of time with some of the visual artists at the time who were pretty big names, and his he was a gay man at the time where this was not accepted in this country. Yeah. So and his partner was a dancer and a choreographer, and how they basically hid their relationship for decades. And it wasn't until maybe the 1970s, when they were already like 50 or 60 years old, that they finally lived together, because they were, they were in a relationship in the 50s where that was, you could have gone to jail for that. So it's a really in-depth, excellent book. I really loved it. So you should check it out, Anna.
We'll check that out. It sounds really interesting. Cool. Yeah.
Now, Anna, I'd like to move on to what we had kind of intended to talk about today. We were going to talk about special needs in science fiction and fantasy. And that what sparked that idea was that you emailed us and told us that you were diagnosed Asperger's. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about your background and how that influences you as an author and as a person.
I'm Asperger's. I'm also dyslexic and dyspraxic. And dyslexia is, most people are familiar with dyslexia. I have some issues with reading and writing and spelling and handwriting. I kind of, basically without a computer, I'm kind of semi-literate. My handwriting is so appalling that it's just illegible and I can't keep up with my own thoughts. I can only really kind of, before computers, I don't think I'd have been able to be a writer at all. I really would have struggled writing. I really struggle writing longhand. Dyspraxia is much less known. It's kind of, you get all these books for children with these different conditions, and they're always labeled things like the gift of Asperger's, dyslexia, the creative mind. Then the one for dyspraxia is just called dyspraxia, the hidden handicap, with a picture of a child crying on the front. Because dyspraxia it's an issue with motor skills. So I'm quite clumsy. I can't drive. I can't play musical instruments. I'm rubbish at sport. I'm that person in the back who's always dropping the ball, and like I'm the person in the aerobics class who's going left and everyone else goes right and flapping my arms around. And I'm kind of, I've got really weird issues with my motor skills. But none of this was diagnosed until I was an adult. I kind of had this ridiculous thing where I spent 10 years in therapy talking to all these different psychologists and psychiatrists and union analysts and kind of any kind of, like, so many different forms of therapy, all to kind of try and get to the bottom of why I thought there was something wrong with me and why I felt so different from other people and why I felt I couldn't relate to other people. And then finally, in my early 30s, someone kind of realised that the reason I always felt I was different and I always felt I couldn't fit in with other people and I found it really hard to relate to people wasn't because of something that happened back in my childhood and wasn't kind of tell me about your mother or wasn't kind of, it was because there's something kind of a bit wrong with me and I'm a bit different to other people. that was 10 years of therapist bills completely wasted. It's weird because obviously it's really hard to try and realise and get my head around the idea that I maybe do see things in a different way to other people or maybe do think in a different way to other people. It's really, really, it's bizarre. It's like, it's actually kind of like, so a friend of mine had this bizarre thing where it turned out he was colorblind. It was this bizarre thing where he was saying, his girlfriend said, "Oh, this is my Christmas coat I'm wearing." And he looked at her and said, "Why is it your Christmas coat?" And she said, "Oh, because it's dark green. It looks like a Christmas, same color as a Christmas tree." And he looked at her and said, "No, it's not, it's black." And it turned out he was colorblind and he had no idea that he wasn't seeing dark green and dark red, just on the back. And of course, you could never describe to him what dark green it looks like or what dark red looks like, because he can't see them. He can't, you know, it's impossible to describe a color to someone like that. And it's kind of like that for me. It's really weird now thinking, I went through my whole life seeing the world in a slightly different way, apparently, to other people. Obviously, I will never be able to understand what it is that's different and what it is that is going to, what I know that there's this, I know that there's something kind of slightly weird about the wiring of my brain, but what actually it is that I'm somehow relating to the world in a different way. It's, of course, it's impossible for me to ever understand. It's weird. It's kind of weird. It's really weird. It's still something I find it really weird to get my head around even several years later.
And when you were diagnosed in your early 30s, was that a sense of relief almost, like that there was an explanation for perhaps some of the challenges that you were experiencing?
Oh God, yeah. I mean, you know, just to know from kind of that, you know, almost that kind of sense of it, I was right, that this kind of people kept talking about, why did I think I was different from people? What was this huge problem I had? Why couldn't I just pull myself together and just kind of buck up and just kind of stop kind of feeling different to people? And the reason, you know, the kind of wonderful kind of sense of pressure that was taken off of, well, it's not a matter of just, you know, bucking up and just somehow, what on earth is going on that I think there's something weird about me, that, you know, that the pressure that was off, that actually kind of maybe there is something kind of different about me and I don't need to go through this kind of agony about why I think this. But no, it was kind of, it does make a huge amount of sense. It really does make a great bit of sense about kind of understanding myself.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, dyspraxia.
Yes.
I don't know if I'm saying that right. So that's something with your motor skills being affected by that, where it's some sort of wiring in the brain where your body's not responding in the way that you would like, and you're saying it is there a reason why you might be a little clumsy or uncoordinated? I would suspect that would be quite a relief to have that diagnosed, because we're so critical of people who are, I am, like, I try not to be, but you know, I'm around a lot of children because I'm an elementary school teacher, and you know, when kids are clumsy or they drop stuff or they trip over their own feet or whatever, what do we say as adults? Pay attention to what you're doing.
Yeah.
You know, we always blame it on, so I'm sure you got that your whole life where they were like, Anna, pay attention to where you're walking. Anna, be more careful. Was that a lot of your life? Was people telling you to pay attention and be more careful?
Yeah, a lot of that sort of stuff. I mean, it's interesting kind of, constantly just kind of focus, why can't you concentrate? And that, and of course the whole thing with sports as well, and I mean, that whole kind of culture around, I'm sure a lot of people listening to this podcast probably do have that horrible experience of having not in any way categorized geeks and nerds, that kind of, I'm sure many of you are amazing professional athletes, but I kind of, there are many of us, I feel, who were the ones at the back of the queue when the who's going to be on the team was picked, and that horrible, horrible, mortifying sense of knowing that you were going to be crap and you were going to be rubbish, and everyone was going to laugh at you because you were never going to manage to kick the ball or throw the ball or hit the ball, and that's still such a big thing. That's such a kind of huge thing, that kind of being crap at sport is some kind of massive, it's considered to be some kind of moral failing somehow, in a way that kind of other things aren't. That kind of, you know, everyone has their things, everyone has their strengths and weaknesses, apart from at school in sports, where you're somehow at some kind of moral failing. And that was, it was awful. Makes me feel ill just remembering the standing there when they're picking the teams. No one wants you.
Yeah, and I think nowadays people that are adults, like we are, you do get diagnosed now as an adult. I don't know how many adults that I know now that are diagnosed with attention deficit disorder or ADHD or some kind of anxiety issue. Whereas when they were kids, it was, oh, you're overreacting to this, or, oh, you can't pay attention. It was always, it's your fault. you said, I think your words were, oh, buck up and do this, or,
yeah, yeah,
or they're just not good in school because they don't, they're not trying hard enough. And I can tell you, as someone who teaches elementary school children, fortunately, that has improved dramatically, where these sorts of issues are dealt with much earlier. We're much more sympathetic towards those potential problems that they can have. It's not perfect. Look, there are children that go way too long without being handled properly, and they struggle through school, both academically and perhaps socially as well. But the people that get the sort of supports, whether that is educational supports or medication or therapy or whatever the case may be, they do much better. And it's sort of like the adults of our generation just had a kind of bear, not to be, oh, woe is me about our generation. We had a lot of benefits too, but it just wasn't really even on the radar. I mean, did you even hear of these things when you were 10 years old?
It is really positive. And I mean, as you say, it's interesting, the number of people I know who are adults now who people are diagnosing them, and they're kind of realizing, you know, things are making sense. And that it is interesting that, yeah, no, people, children do seem to get much more support now, do seem to be kind of, people do seem to be actually kind of seeing things in a more, and actually being more positive about kind of how you respond to things. I mean, obviously I'm really lucky because I'm a high functioning Asperger's. So, I mean, I got a PhD before I was diagnosed as Asperger's. And I guess the fact that the one thing I always knew I was good at was academic stuff. It's not a surprise I had a PhD in some ways. I had no social life for years. I was the kid who got picked on massively for being crap at sports. I was in the library all the time, kind of no friend, really no mates with a big pile of books. It's not really surprising in some ways I got a PhD, but you know, I did, you know, Asperger's, autism spectrum is a massive spectrum to children my mum has worked with who are non-verbal, who have, you know, obviously huge issues fitting in within a social environment, which I didn't have. I mean, if a family where a child has autism and is non-verbal and is physically aggressive and cannot control their kind of feelings of anger and their feelings of unhappiness, then that this is a totally different thing to having someone with high-functioning Asperger's like me in the family. But the idea that actually things like Asperger's are a way of being rather than a problem is becoming more prevalent. Is that kind of, it really, really makes me so angry. Everything makes me about the anti-vaxxers makes me angry, but the way they talk about, the anti-vaxxers talk about the idea that a vaccine can cause autism as if autism is some kind of massive disease and kind of, you know, the best thing for me would be if someone cured me, is really upsetting, because I would never want to be cured of whatever it is that makes my brain work the way it does. And it's the fact that people are more accepting of just, well, this person thinks in a different way and needs different supports, and maybe needs more support, but isn't ill, isn't, you know, it's not, this isn't some kind of problem that we have to treat, this is something we just need to support, is fantastic and is becoming more and more socially acceptable. Although, as I say, my experience obviously is totally different. It's totally different. It would be totally different, I imagine, for a family where a child is nonverbal and just a ball of nonverbal aggression, which obviously would be, I guess, if you said to someone in that situation, would you like to cure, in inverted commas, your child? They probably would say yes, and the child would probably say yes as well. So it's complicated. But yeah, no, I think things are much more positive than they were. Try and find some kind of coherent thread in everything I just said.
I'm glad you put it that way. I mentioned before we started recording, one of our first guests that we had on the show many years ago was Blake Charlton, who has a fantasy series out. He is now he's a doctor or something now. Patrick, do you remember what Blake is a doctor of now? He's a cardiologist, maybe?
He's some sort of surgeon.
Yeah, so he is dyslexic, I should say. So obviously he overcame that because he became a published fantasy author, and he's a cardiologist, so he figured it out eventually. But when we met Blake and started this podcast, that was when my son, who's 12 now, when he was early diagnosed on the autism spectrum, and I was reading about it, but I didn't know much about it. And Blake put it in such a good way, where he talked about, you know, sort of the spectrum of our brains and sort of neuroatypical and neurotypical, and just how everyone's brain's a little bit different. And some people's brains are going to be what we consider neurotypical, and some people's brains are going to be in other places, and there are strengths and weaknesses to them. And some things you might be great at and some things you may have challenges with. And many years ago, that really helped me looking at it from that perspective. Because yes, sometimes it's these sorts of things are looked as diseases that can be cured, and it's, but there's nothing to be cured about. Like, you can have therapies to help you get on in the world better. That helps a lot, but there's no pill that's going to make your brain what we would consider neurotypical, because what is that anyway? You know that?
I'd
be curious to hear your thought about that, because that, for me, that's something that is like, well, we're all different. I mean, I know that sounds a little pie in the sky, a little Pollyanna-ish, but it's really true. Like, what is typical anyway?
Because I mean, I kind of find the whole issue of people, you know, that idea of neurotypical and neuroatypical even problematic, because it kind of suggests that kind of, if I'm neuroatypical, that's still that's kind of posh speak for freak, right? That kind of I kind of see it as a continuum, that kind of I kind of see it almost like height in some ways. I mean, like, most people are kind of within, most adults are kind of within between a range of kind of like 5 to 6 feet, and kind of, and if you're really tall or really short, you are kind of socially disadvantaged. That's not a failing in you.
Right.
It's not, and, but actually, you know, it's not, it's kind of not a failing. If you go into a store, if you're 7 feet tall, you go into a store and you can't find a pair of trousers that fit. That's not a failing in you. And actually, that's kind of not a failing in the shop either, because they're not going to stock, you know, 17 pairs of trousers for 1 7-foot guy who's going to be shopping in that town. It's just, it's a mixed match. It means your problem, your life is going to be more difficult. But it's not, you know, it's not anything wrong with you. And it's kind of not anything wrong with society as well, because society, you know, we can't all, kind of, all shops can't stock all their clothes for a height range between kind of 3 feet and 7 feet, just in case. They can only stock, you know, a small number of, you know, society has to function within some kind of averaged out parameters. So, but, and that's, and it's really, really difficult for people who don't quite fit within those parameters. But the issue kind of, it's not saying there's anything wrong with anyone for being kind of, does this make any sense?
I think it's a good point, because
it does. I mean, it is difficult in some ways. You know, my life, I have really bad facial recognition. I really can't cope with kind of creating patterns and networks in my head. I'm just in an office environment. I'm completely screwed. Basically, I mean, kind of, I cannot cope with the kind of the way big open plan office environment works. I'm hypersensitive to noise and to light. I'm really easily distracted. I find things like variations in temperature to cope with. Basically, there's no aspect of a modern open plan office that I can remotely work within. That doesn't make me, you know, it's not a problem with me. It's not something that's wrong with me. It's not actually something that's wrong with the office either. That's just how offices are set up. It just doesn't work. And it's just kind of, it's not some kind of massive, you know, my office is deliberately going out of its way to make life difficult for me. It just doesn't work. I mean, would I like to treat that bit of myself and sort it out so I could work better in office, so I could actually get promotions for actually earn decent money? In some ways, yes. On the other hand, potentially that could mean somehow bits of me that I really value were changed. It's just, but then, you know, I kind of, anything I say about, oh, you know, it's great being kind of, all the kind of neuro issues I have are great. I love being me. It's fantastic. It means I write these amazing books. It means I see the world in really exciting ways. As I say that to a family who is struggling with a child who is nonverbal, has massive issues with behavioural issues, have massive issues with kind of not being able to express their feelings of anger and feelings of upset, which therefore just come out as physical violence. It's quite difficult for me sitting here on the kind of high end, high achieving kind of Asperger's end of the scale to kind of say, oh, well, Asperger's is simply a different, exciting new way of, other way of looking at the world, because for some, most a lot of families, it is difficult.
As a side note, that open office floor plan that you're talking about, while that might be just a nightmare for you, it's not exactly pleasant for everybody else either. And they're kind of figuring that out. You know, the big software companies like Microsoft and Apple and different they and Google, they were the ones who pioneered that, because it made sense from a fiscal viewpoint for them to have this open office, and they can just shove everybody in there. They don't have to have all these individual offices. It's easier on them from a furniture standpoint, all this kind of stuff. What they've discovered after years of doing that floor plan is that it just kills productivity because everybody's distracted by everybody else. And what's funny is now those big companies are going away from that floor plan and that concept, while other little companies are now starting to adopt it, because they're only now catching up to where Google and Microsoft and these other companies were 10, 15 years ago. So my company that I work for moved to a new headquarters, and they did the open floor plan. And I am absolutely miserable because I sit at a table across from my boss, and there's a television set on the wall behind me. And we are a sports company. We're a golf company. And so they have the golf channel on the TV all day long. And what's worse is everybody on our team hates it except for our boss. Yeah. He's the only one who says he can't work unless there's lots of noise going on. So he turns the TV up. And all the rest of us are going, we can't work with the noise. It's too distracting. And he says, well, that can't be true. And so the TV is on all day long behind me. And there are now, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 people in that room other than my boss. So 12 total. You have 11 people wearing headphones.
Oh, God.
And one person sitting there with the TV on.
Yeah. See that? I mean, that's just that kind of inability to think that other people think differently. I mean, in some ways, one of the things people sort of talk about, the gift of creativity of these kind of neuroatypical conditions, I think the fact that you're forced to realize that other people don't think in the same way as you, and that therefore kind of maybe that's the biggest gift. Maybe that's the huge gift that I've got. I'm forced to constantly confront the fact that other people think in different ways, and obviously think in total and just respond to the world and see the world in totally different ways. And maybe that means that I wouldn't behave like that. You know, I don't know. Maybe that total lack of awareness of how anyone else might think or feel. It's just, it's so typical and yet so kind of, that's just at the root of everything.
Well, and they've done studies now, and they show that those kind of environments, people are so distracted because they're worried what other people are thinking about their actions. So if you're sitting there and you're doing your work, you're worried about what other people are thinking that you're doing. And then you always have the person who is on the phone. Right. And there's someone on the phone and you're sitting there going, oh, my God, I wish you would not be on the phone right now. It's so distracting. And the person on the phone who is having to take phone calls is going, is everybody listening to my phone call? And so it just creates this horrible environment. Now, amp that up for someone who has been diagnosed as you have. Right.
Yeah.
I that would be a horrible, horrible nightmare of a situation to be in.
No, it's actually kind of, it's somewhere get the experience of some of the kind of the sort of violence in my books. Actually, they kind of, people talk about the way I write about the kind of emotional experience of kind of violence and of sort of this kind of being in this incredible, being in the middle of a battle scene. And I think that probably is based on, It is that sense of experience just feeling completely out of control in something bizarre, like, yeah, an office environment where people on both sides of me are on the phone, and I've got, and yeah, kind of just that sense of complete panic and kind of, so there we go. Yeah, but I think, yeah, that kind of, that absolute just sense of physical panic. I do feel it as a physical panic, being sometimes in that kind of environment where there's a lot of stuff going on and a lot of noise, and I've got deadlines. Sure. And yeah, it is a very kind of physical, visceral feeling. And yeah, we don't have the TV on, thank God. I can't imagine how that would be.
Well, it's hilarious because he'll come in the morning. He's always a versatile there. He turns the TV on, he turns it way up. Then he has meetings throughout the day. So he's never at his desk. He's never sitting at the table across from me. And so he'll get up and walk out, and someone, it'll either be me or someone else, will get up and turn the TV down. And it'll be down for a couple of hours. And then he'll come back and he'll be sitting there for a little bit, and then he'll get up and turn it up. It's hilarious. It's like this little dance that we're all doing. I have social anxiety.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, if I'm invited to an event or a party or something like that, my initial reaction is to say, no, I can't go. And I always have to take a breath and stop myself from saying no. And then I'll say yes. And then when I go, it's, you know, find the person I know and cling to them.
And then let me ask you this, Anna, like as Patrick brings that up, and maybe we can start wrapping it up with this. Have you spent much time at conventions then with your books?
Yes.
And
yes,
how is that for you then? How does that work for you?
See, this is interesting. You know, I was at Worldcon in San Jose this summer, and it's the first time I've ever been to the States. It was amazing. I had such a good time. I go to a lot of UK cons. I was at Worldcon Helsinki last year. I'm going to Dublin next year. And anyone who's listening to this who comes, who sees me at any con, come and say hi. It's weird. It's the books and doing stuff around the books and actually being part of the kind of the fan community. It's like a whole... It's like all my issues kind of go away. I feel totally, if I find an open plan office environment just absolutely, just physically impossible to be in, I just feel completely at home in that kind of fan environment. It's kind of, I mean, it helps, obviously, I'm in a place full of people who share the same passions as I do, who love the same stuff as I love. And you kind of don't get that anxiety because it's just so nice. You just know that these are people who you can talk to about, who share something, you have something in common with. But I just feel very, very incredibly relaxed in that kind of environment. This is what I was born to do, and I'm finally doing it. But it really does feel like that. Kind of, I just feel absolutely, I feel absolutely kind of in my elements around cons. I mean, obviously I stick with the people I know, in terms of, kind of, I usually try and I have a little posse I attach myself to, but I'm also really just happy to talk to people who are just complete strangers and just chat to people and just be on my own and mix with people, because it just feels different somehow. It feels like really, it just feels easy somehow. Maybe kind of, it's just that they're just such nice places to be as well. They're just so full of nice people, and kind of, yeah. And everyone's just very accepting. I kind of get the feeling kind of, sometimes I'm joking earlier about kind of, oh, I'm sure lots of people listening to us have that horrible memory of being the last one to be picked from the team. But people are very accepting, and people aren't judgmental in the fan community, and people are just very, I mean, I've been fairly straight with people about kind of, oh God, that sounded really awkward, didn't it? I'm sorry. I'm not very good in some situations. And people are just absolutely just kind of, they're just very welcoming of people in the way that they think in those kind of situations.
Okay, I'm glad to hear that is has been your experience with it. That's mine too. Well, it is about time to wrap it up. Once again, Anna Smith-Spark, she is the author of the Empires of Dust series, published by Harper Voyager in the UK and Orbit in the US. You can follow her on Twitter at Queen of Grimdark. Her website is courtofbrokenknives.org. Is there anything else that you want to let our listeners know about before we wrap it up today, Anna?
Oh, I don't think so. No, I mean, no, I I'm coming over to the States more and more. I'm coming over to Dublin. Actually, it's clearly not in the States, but I'm going to WorldCon Dublin. And I know some people, I know a lot of people are planning, a lot of people from the US are planning to go over there. And I'm thinking about coming over to a US bar as well in the summer. So, just if you see me, do come and say hi, please. I always love people to come out and say hi to me. And I had a really nice time in America and I really want to come back.
Excellent, excellent. Once again, for us, if you enjoy the show, consider becoming one of our backers over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. And for the people who are already backing us, thank you. We really do appreciate it. Patrick, what would you like to leave our listeners with today?
Nothing much. Just a reminder that I'm going to be at the Peak to Peak Brewery. So if you check my Facebook, you'll see that I shared the event. I believe it's on the 27th from like 6 to 10 or something like that. I don't have the details right in front of me, but I'll be there with a bunch of other local authors showing off our books and talking and doing signings and all that good stuff.
Awesome. All right, everybody. Thanks for listening and we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Mo.
I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves. And I hope we pass the audition.
Still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Would you like a chili, baby?
I'm the one in the middle.